This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease. And the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and 2 tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Britt Edelin, and I'm here today joined by Kaz Sagafi, who is an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Memphis. And we're here today talking with him about his book published through the State University of New York Press titled The World After the End of the World, A Spectropoetics. Welcome, Kaz.
Thank you, Britt. Happy to be here.
It's great to have you here today. As I mentioned when we were talking before we started recording, I loved this book. It was so great to read. A lot of really thought-provoking questions, and we'll get into them. But my first question is, you know, can you give us a little bit of your intellectual background as well as how you came to thinking about the questions that led you to writing this book?
Well, that requires a long answer. I will try to be brief. I did my studies in philosophy, in continental philosophy, at DePaul University in Chicago. It was there that I worked with Michael Nass, who's a translator and an expert on the works of Derrida. I joined the University of Memphis after holding several other jobs. I teach at a university in a department that is a pluralist department. I don't know if that really makes much sense in terms of theory or comparative literature. Philosophy departments tend to have a certain sense of being able to bring together different branches of thought. And I happen to have simply worked in continental philosophy. I have no background in analytic philosophy, which for me, it puts me at a disadvantage where I teach. I have always been interested in Derrida's work. I did my dissertation on Derrida. I was very lucky to be able to attend Derrida's seminar in Paris. And since then, or even before then, I have been interested in his work. So I did my first book on the notion of apparitions, looking at this thing that he had been thinking about having to do with specters. And I tried to explain what that might mean and also what it might mean for a philosopher to think about those things. And by philosopher, I mean a person in my position, because I do not simply consider Derrida as a philosopher. He is beyond that, I would say. So that is my background, simply put. How I got to this book, that's a difficult question to answer. The chapters that the book contains, I had been thinking about for a long time. But unfortunately, as it's evident when you look at the beginning of the book, this had to do with the fact that my wife, who was my partner, who was my wife for 25 years, and I actually went to undergraduate school with and graduate school, passed away very suddenly. And it not only plunged me into mourning, it forced me, as I say, to think about how do we understand death, thinking about Derrida's work. What has he said about death? How do we come to terms with this notion? And of course, I happened to have as my background a work that I had been working on, helping two of my professors when I was in graduate school, which was entirely on the work of mourning. So I had unfortunately had an intellectual background in this topic. And when the time for actual mourning, of course, as far as Derrida is concerned, one is mourning before a death. When it came to my mourning, let's put it that way, I was struggling to not only think about that death, but also to find out what I could say about it. So this is how the book came about. I think that's what I can say.
Okay, well, you bring up a few things that I'm sure we'll talk about. But I want to start by asking a few questions about maybe some basic guidelines or thoughts how we might structure this interview, which you bring out in the text. So my first question is related to the title, and it's called The World After the End of the World.
Yeah.
And I think the two main points in that are world and end. And I think that what you're doing with this, as well as what Derrida is doing with this, is troubling what we might think of as end and what we might think of as world. Can you give us maybe just a brief way of thinking about of the words world and end, and how they're not actually, you know, like the word world in Derrida's, he actually, like, maybe there's not a world. There's not a world or the world. What does that mean?
One of the ways that I try to do this is to investigate philosophically, looking back to the very beginnings of thought, of Greek thought, to see what we have understood in the European world, which is the inheritance for continental philosophy generally. How have we understood the notion of world? And obviously there have been many different worlds designating the notion of world for us now. So a historical search allowed me to look at how have we understood the notion of the world, philosophically speaking. Then I also looked at how Derrida discusses the notion of world. And interestingly, I started really at the end of his, toward the end of his writing rather than from the very beginning. He had written an introduction preface to a text that was only published in French. It was supposed to be the French version of an English book that came out. It's called The Work of Mourning. The French text has not been completely translated into English. And what Derrida says in the introduction to this book is very, very intriguing, because he has Jean-Luc Nancy involved because he is trying to think about the notion of world and the end of the world. And he is saying that the notion of the end of the world, as we have understood it, let's say in the Christian West, or however you, European West, however you want to understand this, means that there is a place that we live in and exist in. It's called the world. And when someone dies, someone in the world has died. And this continues the very thought of the world as we have understood it. What Derrida says, and he had been doing so in his very late writings, I'm suggesting, that he was really thinking about the notion of world. Not the world, but just world. And he was linking it to the question of the other and the other's death. So very similarly, if I can say it in this way, the way Levinas talks about the other, for example, and he only mentions in his early writings, in his first major writing, Totality and Infinity, he's just talking about the other. And this involves all kinds of complications in the terms of the translation of whatever word that Levinas is using. But my point is that what Derrida is doing is he is thinking anew this notion of world, and he links it to the death of the other. And he says that the world, not a world, ends when the other dies. Well, naturally, this means there will be many ends. There won't be just one end. And of course, end is a complicated term in philosophy too. It means, it can mean what is the goal of something, what is the end of something, as well as here being the end. The world is la fin, which is pretty much the same thing as we would translate as the end. What I'm suggesting is that with the thought of the death of the other, Derrida is forced to rethink what has been called world in the entire tradition of thought, in Western thought. And this is a kind of a controversial thought. I don't know if too many people who are Derrida experts totally agree with this, because the notion of the world and the notion of globalization, or as it's been translated, worldwideization, is prevalent all over Derrida's later work. So he does discuss the notion of world. What I'm suggesting is that he is working with a notion that we all understand to mean world. But toward the end, the question of death of the other, mourning, etc., force him to bring him to rethink this notion of the world. So the reason why I'm saying this is that he titles what was in English called The Work of Mourning. He decides to call it Chaque fois unique, la fin du monde. So each time unique, the end of the world. And one is forced to think, well, what does this mean? What does Derrida, what is he working toward? This is a book that collects Derrida's essays, eulogies, you could say, about his friends and colleagues over many years. So each of these deaths force the reader to think about death and mourning. And now Derrida, trying to bring this these essays together and publish them in French, Michael Nass and Pascal Imbro had edited it in English. I'm thinking that it made him or forced him to think about all of these deaths and how does one bring these deaths together and should one bring those deaths together? If each death, to a certain extent, is very singular, then should they be collected? Should they be put together? And what does it mean to put them together? As he is suggesting that each time death is unique and it means the end of the world, each death. So for me, this was extremely provocative. And of course, with Plachette's death, I had to really think about this and to see what it could possibly mean and how I would be able to make anything of it by looking at all the things that he has said about death and what happens after death, if there is such a thing, what is there an afterlife? And of course, then I had to deal with the question of resurrection, which is a notion that Jean-Luc Nancy has been thinking about and which Derrida has contested. And he says in that preface that there is no such thing as resurrection. Death spells the end of the world. Sorry, this is a long-winded answer.
No, I think it's great, and it brings us to a lot of what we'll end up talking about. And I want to move from there to where you begin with Derrida, or close to the beginning at least, which is his reading of Paul Celan's Große Ruhende Wölbung, which is Great Glowing Vault. And the last line in that poem is, I'll read it in English and then in German. So the last line is, the world is gone, I must carry you. And that is, die Welt ist fort, ich muss dich tragen. And these two sentences, these two clauses are separated by a comma. They're totally together. There's just a small splice between them. Can you talk about how you and Derrida are approaching this sentence, especially in relation to how the being gone of the earth, or the world, ist fort, how that relates to the imperative, the need to carry, or the promise to carry, that I must. It's not I am, it's not in the present or present indicative, it's I'm yes. going to have to do this.
Yes, it's a duty, Derrida says. It's my duty. First of all, Derrida was obsessed with this line from Celan. And obviously he was, Celan was his colleague and he read Celan over many, many years. But this particular line really interests him. And he writes about it in different contexts and in different places. What he tries to do, the way I understand it, is that he reinterprets what we call die Welt. So the world, it is not the world that we have understood as this globe, this place that we all live in, that we can look at synoptically using a satellite. And so that's how we understand the world. Derrida is linking this notion of world and thinking it differently with the next clause that is the end of the world. And the end of the world, as I try to explain, is not the way it's been understood, certainly in America, as a kind of apocalyptic, biblical thing that everyone is fearful of, that the world is going to end. He is suggesting that the end of the world is actually related to death of the other. And it is the death of the other that spells what he calls the end of the world. And this means that when every other dies, the world ends. Now, he says, not the world as we understand it, but as he is thinking it. I'm not sure if this has been really noticed or worked on as much as it ought to be, or certainly the way it affected me. He uses Celan to try to explain what the death of the other spells. It spells as I try to explain, the way he's understanding what he is calling the other stands on a ground. Every other stands on a ground. When the other dies, the ground founders, they do not stand on a ground anymore. They fall into the abyss. There is no ground to buttress their stance in this world. That indicates for Derrida that what we understand as the world, which is a kind of foundation that we all stand on, the ground upon which we stand, vanishes. And it is the death of every other that causes that and causes us to rethink what we mean by the world. Therefore, we need to, the implication would be that we need to think the world, not in terms of a globe, not in terms of a wide expanse, the way that we have thought about it in terms of the cosmos and all that stuff, but he's relating it, he's making it much more singular and you could say smaller because he's linking it to the other. I don't know if that makes sense.
So I was very interested by this, this relationship to the other that is founded on death and this duty to the other. And you bring up one of my favorite texts of Derrida's, The Politics of Friendship, which in it, he describes how the kernel of a friendship is the knowledge, implicit or explicit, that one of you will live on beyond the other, and you will have to bear their name. You will have to speak for them or on behalf of them. And I think, I can't remember which eulogy or essay it is in The Work of Mourning, but he's asking about whether or not he can speak for the other, or how that might happen if he's eclipsing them, or if he has the ability to. So I'm wondering, can you say more about how this relationship of philia or of friendship relates to death, and how this perhaps something that we never want to think about actually lies at the origin? So the end is the beginning, in fact.
Right. You bring up the notion of friendship. He says the same thing about mourning too. So my relationship to the other begins with the fact that I'm not sure if I would call it a knowledge, but I am aware that the other will die. One of us will die before the other. And that constitutes the relationship of friendship, the relationship love, you could say, anything like that. With the fact that one of us will have to mourn the other one, and one of us will have to see the other go. Therefore, this constitutes really the the major aspect of the relationship to the other is related to the question of death. So previously we have said that human beings are mortal, we are aware of our mortality and all of that. But Derrida singularizes this. And it's interesting, it's singular, but it's repeatable with every death. So it's not just one death, but every relation with the other means that one of us will die first. And my job, my duty will be to mourn this friend. Even if I don't, he says, I already mourn the friend before their death, because it's a structural thing that he's thinking. But I actually do have to mourn their death as well. It is what death causes and brings about. And this forms the basics of the relationship to the other for Derrida. And he will repeat this, that this is structural. He's not being melancholic or anything like that. Death is part and parcel of the relationship to the other.
Mm-hmm. So I want to move into a different discussion that also employs terms that we'll have to think through or parcel out. And I'm thinking of like the concept of survival, especially as we think of that as a relationship to otherness. So for example, in, you know, obituaries, they'll name the deceased and then say, they are survived by.
Yes. So
I'm wondering, so can you talk about how you're thinking about survival in relation to Derrida? And I think also that we need to make the distinction that you draw out in this, that Derrida and others draw out, the difference between survivance,
yes,
and survie, so the different types of survival and what each one implies.
You ask all the tough questions, Britt. This is a difficult question. I have actually sat before Jeff Bennington, who translated The Beast and the Sovereign, and he pronounces it, and I was first very interested to find out, he pronounces it like it's an English word, survivance. That's how he pronounces it. So he has turned it into an English word rather than, you know, fancy-sounding French word. But survivance is different from survival. The survival that you mentioned, for example, in obituaries, they say that so-and-so is survived by spouse, children, etc. They live on after him or her, and this person is dead. What Derrida calls survivance tries to rethink the relationship between life and death. And he says that what he's calling survivance makes possible the distinction between life and death. So Derrida was always thinking about the relationship between life and death from very early on. And very recently, a seminar was published in French and English called Life, Death, in which he's trying to think the relationship of life, death, by bringing these two words together, not separating them with a hyphen or a slash or anything like that. So he wants to think, what kind of connection do life and death have with each other? And he has always contended that life is riven with death. It's not that death just comes after life. And he also wants to think this notion of death as if it is haunted by a certain kind of liveliness or the notion of life. So they're not opposites, as he has always done with all kinds of binary distinctions. So for him, survivance is not exactly what we call survival. And in previous texts where he has written on this and he had spelled this word, he wrote about survival as survie, but the sur was hyphenated by V. So on life, in English, it's been translated as living on. But I think it's more than living on, this notion of survivance that he's thinking about. But if I could simplify it, it's a natural question that human beings have thought about people who die. What happens to them? Where do they go? Do they live on or not? And of course, religions are based on this notion of afterlife. And of course, Christianity that forms really a major basis of European thought has a thought of the afterlife in which the dead are not just dead. And they go on. And in fact, the better life is not on earth, and Nietzsche criticized this, is elsewhere. So what I had to think about is that, okay, how does one think about this survival without necessarily being religious, Christian, believing in the fact that there is some other world that we all go to after we die? That would be too simple. So surely that is not what Derrida is thinking about. But what he's thinking about is not so easy to delineate, to figure out, because in as many people have quoted, the thing that he wrote, the message that he wrote for his son to read out loud at his funeral is very interesting. He talks about everyone. He urges everyone to not be tearful. I'm just summarizing it. But he, at the end, kind of says, like, I'll be smiling at you from wherever I am. And this is not clear. This is mysterious. What does he mean by that? Did he believe in an afterlife? All of these things that have led to all kinds of discussions. And some people say, I myself have said that, there's no resurrection. Derrida doesn't believe in resurrection. He doesn't, even though Jean-Luc Nancy does. But what I've just read, what I just told you about what was read out at his funeral, does that indicate that he believes in an afterlife? I don't know. It's not a cut and dry thing that we can say, well, yes, he did or he didn't, or it was or it wasn't. It's not like that, which pushes the reader to think about even further what he said about life, death, the relationship between life, death, that he does really fabulously in this life, death seminar, and in which he reads, he starts with Hegel, but then he reads famous French theorists of biology who have talked about the notion of the living. And he analyzes these things to see what is meant by life and the living. I think that's about as much as I can say.
So I'm glad you bring up Derrida's own death, because it was, it was 2008, right? Around then?
It was before then.
2000, I don't know. I'm just guessing.
I think 2004.
Four? 2004.
Yes.
Okay, so eight is a multiple of four. There we go. So I'm interested in this, and you bring up, many times throughout the book, Derrida's text Aporias, which is kind of where he talks a lot about his own death. And he knows it's coming. And I think it's interesting to get this, a philosopher or a theorist's his own thoughts on his own death, because there's that relationship of philosophy to death that is inherent in it. So you have like Plato and Phaedo talking about, philosophy is learning how to die. I don't know. I think we want to think about philosophy as learning how to live, but if, I mean, this might sound a little too Freudian, but if the goal or end of every life is death, then it is also learning how to die and how to live, how to die properly. So I'm wondering if you can talk about how maybe this relationship between philosophy and death and what Derrida's adding to this conversation, perhaps in a way of saying there's something conciliatory about it. There's, you say, like, you don't have to cry. How does that relate to maybe us carrying on Derrida's legacy, or us carrying on Derrida's thinking, or us just carrying on thinking at all?
I will try to take on, this is a tough question, all of them. So I'll just try to respond to the beginning of the questions that you asked me. I think philosophy, and this is Derrida's belief too, I'm sure, is and calls itself a preparation for death. So, like Montaigne said, repeating the things that Plato had said, and in fact, it's been part of the tradition that life is a practice and preparation for death. And at the same time, it is, if you look at someone like Hegel, it is death that gives power and energy to philosophy. You can say that it motors it. It is the engine. So if you look, if you read anything by Hegel, Hegel, the negativity of death propels the dialectic. So for Hegel, and after him, death has been a very important concept. So as Heidegger says, we are beings toward death. It is death that individualizes Dasein, because we are aware of an intimate relationship to death. So Derrida is aware of this, obviously. And death is intimately related to life. But what he wants to contest is the power, I would say, the negative power that death is supposed to give to the living, and I guess to philosophy. It enables philosophy to go on, this power of negativity of death. For Hegel, negativity was death. They were synonymous. So with that, not only did Hegel not stop, he went on, because it allows the dialectic to function. This is, you know, Derrida has argued this from very early on. For example, in Glas, and elsewhere, even before that. Sorry, I forgot. I tried to note all of your questions, but you had several. So philosophy is a preparation for death. That's been what we are supposed to do. So from Cicero, from all philosophers, I mean, there's a fascinating thing that, about the brevity of life that Seneca, Cicero, etc. have said, that our job is to prepare for death by not spending on stuff that's useless, not giving too much to friends, but concentrating on one's own tasks and the things that one has to do. And I think Derrida thinks that this notion of death allows a certain view of philosophy to continue. And because it's the opposite of life. And what we are supposed to celebrate, and we always do, and this is not philosophical, but in our country, there is politically always a celebration of life as opposed to death. So questions of abortion, questions of, there are a variety of political discourses that have to do with a celebration of life. One of the things that I really do not like is when you go to someone's memorial session, without asking you, they call it a celebration of life. And this is utterly Christian, because so-and-so, in my case, my wife has died. What is the celebration about? I am not celebrating. She died. She died all of a sudden. So this is, in a way, it's bogus, but ultimately Christian, to say that human life is to be celebrated. Let's not worry too much about death, because that's negative. As all kids will tell me, that why are you so negative about, you know, death? We are supposed to celebrate the life of the human being. Therefore, we're not supposed to be down about it at all. And the question of mourning culturally in our culture is very vexed, because I have personally have had to deal with it differently from, let's say, theoretically, which I have also have dealt with. Everyone is concerned, why are you so unhappy? And why don't you get better soon? As if you are somehow upsetting them by being in mourning. And you should be over it. And they quote you as if you don't realize. They quote you Freud. Not that they quote Freud, but Freud said that, you know, the process is supposed to end after a certain time. He doesn't say why or how, but it ends. Therefore, mourning is over after a period of time when we go back to life, to the concerns of life. And this, I don't think Americans know, generally speaking, whether they're being Freudian or not, but they certainly believe in that. And that the amount of time that they allow someone to mourn has lessened and lessened. So you're supposed to, like, really quickly get to it, go back to life, be happy. And I think this is part of the philosophical Christian roots, you know, philosophy differently, going back all the way to Plato, Montaigne, Hegel, literally all of Christian Western philosophy. But now you add Christianity to it, which entered philosophy from the Middle Ages, where it is forbidden to mourn, for a long time, because it's just negative. You have to move on quickly and celebrate life. And life is the opposite of death. Sorry, I've talked too much, but this has to do with my own personal experience, which has kind of affected the things that I have also written or thought about.
Yeah, no, that was a great answer. And I think it gets us, it makes me think in several different directions. I think most proximate right now would be the question of mourning, and how that's a duty. And I think we touched on this earlier about how there's a primary or a primordial mourning in every relationship. But you talk about the time of mourning later in the book, and I'm wondering, can you say more about what it means to be the time of mourning as the time of survival, and how these two operate together, and how, what might it mean to mourn in a Derridian way rather than, you know, just get over it? How can mourning operate to really fashion how we have relations with others?
Well, to just get to the last question, I think he would say something like, mourning is intricately involved in all relationships with others, family members, loved ones, partners, however you want to look at this. It is, you cannot do without it, because one of the two of us will die first, and that is part and parcel of all relationships. And this is not necessarily being mournful or negative or whatever, but he wants to say this is the if you want to say it this way, this is the reality of all relationships, all ties, all bonds involve the awareness that one of us won't be around, and we won't be able to see the other one forever. So this injects the question of death, which some philosophers have said with the question of finitude and mortality, they have said that we die, accept it. So there are certain readings in philosophy, in particularly after Nietzsche or Heidegger, or in particular the what they call the existentialists. They all argue that this is it. This is the only earth, the only world that we know. We die, get over it. There's nothing after it. I wanted to ask, is this the same thing that Derrida thinks? And certainly, well, he's not an existentialist. And I don't really think he thinks that death and life are opposed. And this forces us to think, so then how does he think of death? Yes, as far as our Christian background in philosophy, yes, the soul, since Plato, the soul lives on. The body dies. Therefore, there is a part of us that is out there somewhere, possibly in heaven if you're a Christian, or other religions also. But I'm sure that's not what Derrida is thinking. So what is he thinking then? And I did not, and I don't think I have a straight answer to give you, but you brought up the question of survivance. And what happens when death occurs? When we say survival, we either refer to the people who have survived the death of a loved one, or maybe religiously, philosophically, we say that the person who has died survives elsewhere, in another world. Now, if you don't believe in another world, that makes things difficult for you. What I think is Derrida has pushed all of these thoughts, not saying that there is another location or another place, even though I do think he is thinking this. And I try to show that by appealing to Freud, he is thinking about a certain topos in which the dead are. But we have no access to it because he talks about the unconscious and consciousness, both of them having to do with the living and the time of the living. Therefore, where a dead person might be, there is no time and there is no consciousness. But what he's hinting toward, I am very interested in. And I think Jean-Luc Nancy also picks up on this in his later thought. He does write certain things. Of course, he's going a direction that I don't think Derrida would go. But he is wondering if there is such a thing as a survival. Although survival, what do we mean by it? Does the body survive? Does the soul survive? What survives? Nancy says there are molecules that are out there. I mean, one has to really think this through. But he is pushing this thought as much as he can. I don't think, as I said, I don't think Derrida believes this. But one would have to say, if there is a thinker who has been pushing the limits of death and life and constantly, pervasively thinking about the limits of life and death, surely the notion of the limit has, well, he has certainly rethought it. And the limit does not mean something comes to a stop or an end. And certainly for Heidegger, it didn't. So in Aporia's or Aporia's, Derrida is thinking that the whole notion of limit, what does a limit mean? Because death has traditionally always been seen as a limit. So life comes to an end, that's the limit. He asks in that text, is death an end? Is death a limit? An end, you know, la fin in both senses of the goal or the finality of death. So I have more questions than answers. I have tried to see what I can suggest, but it is not very clear, or it is not said. How would I say it? I don't think Derrida has come out and uttered and said, "Here's this is what I believe on this notion." I don't think he's done that, and maybe he shouldn't have done that. Anyway, it doesn't make any sense to his way of thinking. But there are enough hints that a reader can follow and to see where it might lead them, where they can push things, things that have been fully understood and accepted in all of Western thought and Western religions. So they have questioned death, obviously. It's part and parcel of everything that forms a religion or a thought. But I don't think Derrida accepts those things that have been accepted.
So I have another question, and this one's large.
Oh.
No. You got me to another question. And this one, I mean, it's a big one. And I think it kind of undergirds, it might be one of the basic tenets of the book or of something that you're trying to get at. And I think of it because you bring up, you say life and death in Derrida are not as opposed. He doesn't speak on it directly. He doesn't say, this is what I think. He dances around and he asks a lot. Or he doesn't dance around. Yeah. He moves around.
Yes.
And so you say maybe he shouldn't have said this because that it wouldn't have been part of his thinking. And I want to get to that question of his thinking and ask, you know, how is deconstruction related to the questioning of death? And maybe why does it open itself up so much to this question and these questions? And I'm thinking especially because of it coming out of Heidegger, Destruktion, and Heidegger's being towards death. And I mean, I don't think, I don't want to say he was obsessed with death, but the whole project of Heidegger is to get us to say, you know, like you have to be constantly aware of your own death. And I think what deconstruction does in a lot of ways is takes things to the impasse, to the aporia, which Derrida does connect to death. How are you seeing deconstruction as maybe proximately related to the question of death, or even maybe even providing more answers than anything else has?
Well, this is a tough question.
Big question.
Yes, it's not really easy to answer. From the very beginning of his writing, Derrida has thought about the relationship. Death has been mentioned throughout, even from the very beginning of his writings on Husserl. By death, he has meant different things that I have tried to explore in one of my chapters in the book. He equates it with the notion of disappearance, not simply death of a human being, but the general notion or concept of death. Fully aware that for Hegel and Heidegger, death played a very important role in their thought and in their philosophy. And as someone who is an inheritor of that tradition, obviously death for him is an important notion. But he doesn't take it up in the same way as Hegel and Heidegger do. He's obviously somewhat influenced by Levinas's writings on death, which question Heidegger's notion of death, and in particular, going to what I said about my book, it is Levinas who wants to move Heidegger away from the death of Dasein, my death, my own death, to the other's death, and make it more important or more primordial, you can say, than my death. So wants to take the emphasis away from me, the I, to that of the other. But death as a concept is bound up with deconstructive thought. Derrida mentions death pretty much everywhere, but they have different meanings. Like, they are often structural terms. They are, you could say, neutral. They don't have to do with the death of an individual. You can call it a concept, but Derrida really doesn't have concepts. But something like that. A disappearance, something not being there. I'm not really, it's difficult to kind of improvise on the thought of death, but something like that. So it's part and parcel of and intricately related to all the things that, you know, Rodolphe Gachet has named infrastructures. Death is bound up. So the relationship to the other, and other does not necessarily mean a human being, but a kind of otherness or alterity, the relationship to death. So deconstruction is bound up with these things. You cannot think deconstruction without a relation to the other, relationship to death, and of course time. So structurally, in that way, deconstruction is related to the question of death from the very beginning. You mentioned aporias, in which Derrida is questioning how death has been taken up sociologically, culturally, and philosophically in the West. So he looks at some famous French writers on the cultural notion of death. But then he also goes to Heidegger toward the latter part of the text, where he wants to question what is called how mortality has been understood. And I think this, what I called existentialist just previously, of course, someone like Sartre and Beauvoir and other people, even Camus, were influenced by Heidegger and Heidegger's emphasis on the question of death. The way that this has been taken up, whether this is what Heidegger is saying or not, is that death constitutes an end for life. It's the termination of life. Because we are beings toward death, we know death is coming, and it motivates all actions of Dasein. Clearly, what Derrida is looking at, first culturally, anthropologically, he wants to assess what have we understood as death in our culture, in Western culture. Then he goes to Heidegger, and he tries to push this notion of being toward death, and to see whether death is an end, a finality, and then if it's not, then what does that mean? What does that mean for death not to be an end? I mean, I don't know what you want to call it, but all of 20th century philosophy is based on the fact that we are death-bound. We are bound for death, we die, and that's it. But I don't think that is what Derrida thinks. And this is a large question and a difficult question. I don't think he ever comes out and says, okay, yeah, you die, that's it. So what philosophy has said, well, yes, you die, so celebrate life, make the best of it, make the best of every moment, death will come soon, therefore, you know, it should motivate your existence and being and your enjoyment, because death will happen. It is an end. Now, if Derrida is saying, no, death is not quite an end, then what does that mean? And this, you asked about the construction and the question of death. So if death has been the motor behind Hegelian thought and what has motivated Heideggerian thought, how does it function in Derridean thought? Well, then we have to come out and say, well, what is death for Derrida? And that's not an easy question to answer. I really don't think it's that simple. And it really does take, like what I've tried to do is, in a very short chapter, kind of elusive chapter, which I'm not too happy about, I don't really say much. I just elusively point toward parts in Derrida's books in which he has talked about death. So his book on Freud, even down as recently as what he has written on Hélène Cixous, on the question of life. And a careful reader will find out that he never comes out and says, or he never puts his foot down and says, this is, we are mortal, we die. That's not the message that he gives us. So you're supposed to think, then what? Then what? What are we supposed to think? We can't think that we go to heaven. We can't go that we, there is some other location that we are transported to, but we can't think that we're going to rot and that's it, which is really, to be honest, that's the philosophical response. If you were to poll contemporary philosophers, they will all kind of say that, that that's it, we die, we rot. There's nothing after that. I don't think that's what Derrida says. So it's my suspicion that this needs to be pushed and explored further. But I don't have answers.
I think that's perfect. I don't think you don't have the answers. Derrida doesn't have the answers. But I think we're getting to the idea that maybe we won't have answers, and our lack of answer is the answer.
Right. Yes.
Well, I have one final question.
Sure.
Okay. Well, if you want to say something else, go ahead.
Well, no, I don't think he's going to pronounce this is my final answer about the question of death. He would. This does not sound very Derridean. He would never do that. But he pushes and reads all the texts in the West, whether they are scientific, whether they're philosophical, to see what we have said about life and death. And for example, toward the end of his life, he wrote in appreciation of Hélène Cixous about life. He wrote a lot about life. And you think, wow, is this the same person who in the late 1960s was saying stuff about death all the time? Yeah, they're not opposites. He doesn't think of them as opposites. But even though he greatly affirms Hélène Cixous, he doesn't quite come out and say, yeah, I'm all for life. He doesn't say that.
Well, I have one final question, and that is, what are you thinking about now? Do you have anything already in the pipeline? Do you have anything on the horizon, or what's occupying your mind?
Your questions and my attempt at answers have made me think that maybe I should think further about this stuff and write more on it. But at the moment, I'm somewhat exhausted with that topic. I have several things that I have had to do. Couple of projects that I owe a publisher because I was involved with Plachette, my wife, in trying to work on both of them. One book we were supposed to write together, which is on the notion of remains, le reste, in Derrida's work, and trying to figure out what this word means in Derrida's corpus. But interestingly, this is also based on an essay that a late essay that Derrida wrote, that Plachette, Diarmuid, and myself we've translated, and will appear in this book. That, strangely enough, is on Indian Vedic thought, and has to do with the remains of food, the remains, in other words, leftovers, and the remains of human beings in Vedic thought. So Derrida explores something that I think he rarely ever did, like another culture in this way. So I have written, since Plachette no longer is here to contribute chapters, which she was planning to do so, I have written several chapters, and I'm going to include the translation that we both did in this book that's going to be called Remains, Jacques Derrida. That's one project. The other project, also initiated by Plachette, who thought about the idea, are two volumes of Derrida's essays that have not been translated or published in English. So it's a collection of something like 20 odd essays or more. The number has not been determined. So they have been translated by several hands, some of them expert Derrida translators, some of them young people who are very interested. And this is going to be a collection that's called Thinking What Comes, and will come out in two volumes, hopefully in 2022. So that's what I've been working on. But there's more in the back of my head that I am thinking about.
As there always is. Well, those sound exciting. And as a Derrida fan, I'll be excited to get my hands on those. And we can have you back on and we can talk about more Derrida.
Well, that would be very kind. I would love that. But you know how the publishing industry is. You hope that it will come out, but you just never know for sure. These translations were supposed to come out earlier, but they haven't yet. So,
well, maybe we can do an underground reading. Well, they're in French. I guess I can read them in French. But I'd be excited to see them in English.
Yes, I think they, they've been nicely translated. People have worked hard on it. And Jeff Bennington, who is my co-editor, I am honored to have him as my co-editor, is checking all the translations. So they ought to be good.
Well, I'm excited. And this was a great interview. I think you've brought up a lot of things for me and for the listeners to think about. And I want to thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you very much, Britt. I really appreciate your concern and you inviting me to say a few things about my work.
No problem. It was an honor. It was a great opportunity. So once again, this was Kaz Sagafi talking about his book, The World After the End of the World. Thank you, Kaz.
Thank you, Britt.
I am... your host, Britt, for the New Books channel, the network, or the New Books Network podcast. Until next time, thank you.